You're listening to 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio, and this is Vico here with The Vico Show. Today on The Vico Show, we are speaking with Paul Helfrich, Ph.D., and Vice President of Technology at New World View. And we are speaking today about the emerging New World View. And first off, Paul, what I'd like to ask you is, what exactly is the perennial philosophy, what is sometimes known as perennial wisdom?
Something that has always been with us and will always be with us. It's, in essence, the common elements in all of the world's religious traditions, but there's a qualification there. That being, if you think of the religious traditions, there's two basic forms to any religion. There's an exterior or more dogmatic, formula-based, ritual-based form, and there's a more interior or esoteric tradition. And the perennial philosophy is a term coined to collect those esoteric elements that are common to all of the world's great and not-so-great religions, and even some of the philosophies. So there's a rich, approximate 3,000-year tradition in our Western society, and certainly in the Eastern cultures, where these seers, sages, and saints of the ancient times and into modern times have written and shared their insights into the nature of reality.
That's very interesting. We're speaking here with Paul M. Helfrich, and he is a writer and lecturer, and this is 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio, and this is Vico here, and we're talking about perennial philosophy and wisdom, which is something shared by all the world's religions, as you just said. Paul, from your experience, what's the best way to approach this wisdom?
I should just give a couple of examples. What can we distill from the world's great religions? It's not the thou shalt and thou shalt not, and you should eat this and you should sing this song. Again, that's the exterior version, the rituals, the dogma. Some examples are just that there is a God or a creative principle or a primary source of consciousness, and the implication there is that consciousness, however you define it, human consciousness, animal consciousness, trees, even matter consciousness, is a primary creative force in the universe. So that's one perennial thought. There are other perennial thoughts too, that the human cycle of development, shall we say, there's an evolutionary pathway that's inherent in human nature. And in our culture, there's been a lot of research in the last 100 years that reflects human development, developmental psychology, thinking of some of the work of Piaget and Abraham Maslow and folks like that, that have done some mapping of how human beings grow through birth, childhood, adolescence, and then adulthood and later adulthood. And we see from the perennial philosophy that there's a very, very small percentage of individuals who have gone through this wave of development, if you want to say, of basically being a human being, who have actually reached what we can just call a transcendental level. That's characterized by saying being in the world but not of it. And historical personages like the historical Christ or Buddha or Muhammad are certainly personalities who, in perennial terms, you would say, achieved a certain level of realization or remembrance or development, and actually got a glimpse into the deeper nature of reality, the deeper nature of human personality, and glean some sort of purpose and design and intent. And another feature of perennial wisdom is, of course, to bring back, so to speak, or divine or discern an ethical point of view. So the ethics, that's a whole huge area But this comes to us through the perennial wisdom and the different ethical systems that you can see.
So you're talking about the development of individuals, and so I'm just the first thought that occurs to me here is how does that work on a species-wide basis? How is the individual, I guess, and the species connected?
Sure. Well, I would say there's the two foundational ways of looking at it is the individual and the collective. And the individual goes through their own set of these waves or states of development, but the individual is not isolated and alone. They relate to the collective. And the idea, I mean, from the perennial wisdom and the religious traditions, I mean, we will bring science into this, and I've already mentioned some of the developmental psychologists, but in the religious traditions, there's a belief system of other realms of being that are non-physical. And something like the belief in angels or angelic beings is an example of that, that they're sentient, aware beings that are not of this world. So human development is related to that. I don't pretend to know exactly how, but it certainly helps to provide a framework to explore and get meaning into the experiences that happen in my individual reality. And then when you scale it up to the immense complexity of the collective, and thinking of mass events and certainly world events, current events, it scales up to a huge, very complicated situation.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot there. This makes me think something maybe good to focus on here is possibly what's your take on individual realities? I guess what Robert Anton Wilson called reality tunnels. Do you have a terminology for that, or?
Where I would go to with that is to use the concept of the worldview. Every one of us has what we can call a worldview, which is sort of a living lens through which we each perceive the world and project outward into the world. It contains all of our belief systems about God, life, the universe, and everything, to quote the late author Douglas Adams. So the worldview of each individual is a key psychological construct that relates to itself intrapersonally and relates to the world around it interpersonally and interspecies-wise and interconsciousness-wise. The other thing I wanted to mention, since we've been talking a little bit about the perennial wisdom, which we could say is a overarching principle of spirituality, of some kind of wisdom from the spiritual traditions. We've mentioned briefly some of the psychological sciences from the last century. And one of the key themes here in this emerging new worldview, which is a larger concept, is the bridging, and how do we go about doing that or integrate science and religion. Now, this is a big topic in the area of consciousness studies, mm-hmm. what's called consciousness studies. And there's been a lot of research, a lot of writing and thinking by theologians, by philosophers, by scientists about this. So there is a view in the future, and the immediate future, the next 10 years, the next 20 years, that holds promise of some sort of integration of bridging science and spirit. And some of these brilliant minds have put forth some wonderful ideas and arguments to suggest that you can't have a mature scientific approach to life without the integration of a spiritual component to that. And nobody is talking about throwing out the baby with the bathwater here. There's not a battle of conquest where one is better than the other. By integrating, there's emergence that occurs, a unification. And I guess in the scientific world, that's represented very generally by their grand unified theory of everything. And of course, from the spiritual traditions, they've always had a holistic sense. And that's an interesting word. By holistic, It includes interior reality, inner reality, as well as physical reality. It includes reality perceived by senses other than our five physical senses. So that's an area of this discussion too, bridging science and spirit. But maybe I'll stop there for now. That integration of science and spirit is a huge area, and there's a lot of different fields and disciplines that are trying their best to incorporate that integration.
Yeah, it seems that work has been going on for quite a while now.
It's been a war for the most part. It's not been pleasant in certain areas where the mostly academic world, where the scholars debate and argue and do their philosophical best to argue their cases. Of course, those are limited by language and the constructs of language. For example, how can you prove the existence of God through calculus? Is there such a thing as a spiritual calculus? And another way of putting that is the experiences of the Buddha and his enlightenment, so-called. Could that be translated into a mathematical equation? I don't believe so. There are mathematicians who do believe so. So there's, you know, it quickly gets very messy. But it's been around for a long time, and there was a split historically back in the 15th, 16th century, where at least in our history, the medieval period ends and the Renaissance began. The Renaissance was, you know, also called the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, and that's where actually there was a fracturing of science and spirit. And I guess science might be loosely characterized by that early time, say the 15th century, by alchemy and other pseudosciences that were emerging at that time. There was a split that happened, and rightfully so, because the famous examples are Nicholas Copernicus and Galileo, two astronomers, the late 16th and early 17th century, who invented telescopes and lenses to look at the world around them through their observations, realized that they didn't think the sun was revolving around the Earth, that the Earth was not the center of the universe, which was the view proposed and accepted by Aristotle. It goes all the way back to the Greek period. So they challenged that through scientific method, and of course, since the political power was very much in the church, there was no separation of church and state at that time, you could be burned at the stake, like another man named Giordano Bruno was, who absolutely knew that the so-called Aristotelian view was not totally accurate. There were gems of truth in it. There's gems of truth in all of these things. And this is sort of what the modern and postmodern folks are starting to discover, that the idea is not to throw out the baby with the bathwater, but take the best practices that we can all agree on, more or less, and move forward with a more complete worldview. So it's really this evolutionary process of less complete, less manifest point of view.
Yeah, personally, I've always looked at it as traditional religion has some wisdom to offer in the explanation of reality, and science also has some as well, but neither picture is by any means complete or even very broad, at least the way I see it. Both are fairly narrow points of view. At least looked at from a certain perspective, because it seems to me so much is left out of both of them.
And I think it's clearer to a lot of people, not the majority yet, but to certain people, that you can never have a complete view. You can never have this search for the so-called theory of everything, or grand unified theory. It is a holy grail that we will be chasing for eternity, I'm afraid, until some sort of integration happens that can transcend the limitations of the models and the types of perception. Again, back to the idea that really the normal, socially accepted mode of perception is our five senses. And don't get me wrong here, I am firmly grounded in my own five senses reality during my day. But a good example that's different from that is your dreaming state, the dream state. Or if you're taking a nap or relaxed somewhere, daydreaming or reverie or visualization, imagination. And of course, from the perennial traditions, yoga and meditation. There are other states that science has interpreted as what they would call parapsychology, to interpret that, or paranormal experiences, you know, the Ghostbusters thing. And it's a fascinating area for science to begin to research, and this is what many scientists realize, that where there are anomalies that we cannot explain scientifically. And I also want to mention, I have spent 10 years as a science educator at a nationally known science museum in Philadelphia called the Franklin Institute. So I spent a lot of time thinking about this and doing projects that were involved with science education. But the work continues.
It seems also, I think you mentioned in your paper that many quantum physicists have actually, in more than one way, pretty much theorized that much of what religion has been saying all along is actually true scientifically, but that this knowledge has just not filtered down to the general populace or even the general population of scientists.
One thing that's interesting, and I do not pretend to be a historian at all, but some of the reading that I've done shows that these scientists in the early 1900s, Max Planck, Einstein, Schrodinger, and those folks, Niels Bohr, who created this quantum physics science and went deep, deep into the structure of matter itself, they were what I would characterize as mystics or closet mystics in their professional lives. They couldn't come and deliver, you know, their faith in God or belief in God in a scientific paper. That just, so it was kind of, I guess that shows this sort of schizophrenic split between science and religion, that these subjective or interior states or spiritual states are just not even brought to bear. And yet, that is what, in my opinion, is driving the scientist to the impulse to want to understand and dissect, in only material terms anyway, what's going on. So quantum mechanics is that science, and some call it quantum mysticism, and it's very controversial. There's different camps who disavow this argument or that argument, but it is the one science that has brought science closer to a spiritual integration. And I guess at this point I should mention the work of Ken Wilber, who's a preeminent American philosopher, who's probably taken it another step forward. We're not going to get into that today, but some of these arguments or points that we can talk about with this are still admittedly incomplete. But this quantum approach shows that weird stuff is happening. In fact, the opposite of what was predicted, you know, that there was the assumption was there's a basic set of building blocks to matter and physical reality, and as soon as we cut down to the, you know, slice it in half and then in half again and in half again, at some point we're going to get to the lowest common denominator. And actually there's an area of theoretical physics still working in that area. It's called superstring theory. The idea that there's these cosmic little fundamental units, the most fundamental physical unit that vibrates at an infinitesimally quick rate, that is the basic building block of all matter, but it's a theory, and it's not been proven yet.
And, I'd say that there's one thing that actually has started to filter down into the population, not completely, but somewhat, is the idea that, from quantum physics, that subatomic particles only exist as probabilities until they are viewed by an observer, and then they materialize into existence because they're observed.
Well, let me just elaborate on that point, which is an interesting thing. They use this mathematical equation called the wave function. I think it was Schrodinger who characterized that and actually quantified the wave function. And until an observation is made by a scientist, that wave function states all the probable states mathematically that an electron could have in orbit around the nucleus of an atom. And once the scientist makes an observation, that wave function is collapsed and a specific probability is manifest. And there's a lot of that one point has been used to argue the case that there is a non-physical reality, a source reality, to go back to the perennial philosophy, the perennial wisdom, that is the source of all physical matter and physical creation. And in fact, that human personality, just to get that angle into the story, human personality is not isolated and separated in the physical world, in a meaningless universe randomly created by chance, that there is a purpose and design to creation, to how it works. But that's still a bit of a mystery. I'm not here to say today that, you know, it can be the ABCs of that or the calculus of the purpose, intent, and design of this non-physical source reality have been codified or proven scientifically. And yet, from 3,000 years of perennial wisdom, again and again, all around the planet, in different cultural contexts, you have those who were able to, for lack of a better description, transcend the five senses only perception and maintain full awareness of self through, and there's different conjectures about different levels or realms or whatever, and that doesn't need concern anybody unless you're living in them yourself. And I don't think many of us are, but it hints at the potential, and it hints on a collective level at the potential for the entire species to, in fact, move forward in a large evolutionary step. And I guess this essay that I wrote, The Emerging New World View, is a way of trying to characterize that collective evolutionary birth pain that we are certainly going through right now. And some people call it a shift in consciousness. That's an interesting phrase that comes through various sources. But that our perception itself, what we consider real, what's acceptable as a real perception, is expanding to include the so-called paranormal. But it's very, very different than just basic material matter. And so we're talking about two or three different major fields and areas of research that still are not integrated with each other, but are adding to the whole mix. And that's the important part, and the part that's very positive, I think, and to a brighter future.
Yeah, I think I've noted that in my own personal experience over the last few years, many times, that everything I see seems to point to the fact that there is some type of expanded awareness, evolutionary development going on at a pretty quick rate right now. And
just on that point, Vico, this acceleration, that's how I characterize it, you can see it all around you. I mean, the growth of the internet and the web and these different technologies, cloning, the biotechnologies, knowledge is expanding at such a rapid rate. And if you imagine there's 6 billion of us on the planet, and about 1 billion, 1 in 6, 1 in 10, are educated, have access to greater amounts of information, and then smaller percentages of those are doing this research and this work, sharing it through these global telecommunications network. That's terrific evidence of this acceleration that's happening. And I've heard that every 18 months, the amount of actual knowledge, published papers, speculative papers, research findings, et cetera, doubles every 18 months. So that's a huge exponential increase. So it's going 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. It's not just a linear progression. And never before in history have we been that developed as a species, and certainly in the Western world and parts of the Eastern world, so-called, been that developed and able to do that. So it's an exciting and kind of terrifying time, too, with all the changes that are happening.
Yeah, it seems to have spawned a lot of violence as well as expanded awareness and knowledge.
Well, we're a violent species, just as evidenced by the past and the history of warfare. Look at the 20th century alone with two great world wars, pretty much in the West, but of course Japan and China were involved in those also in their own ways, the Second World War, Korean conflict, Vietnam. You know, there's been so much violence, and yet the positive side of looking at that is, you know, the vast majority, even in warfare, of the army itself that is in harm's way at any given moment is, I believe, less than 5% or something in that ballpark. So even those that are militaristically inclined and trained to be violent and be very proficient in the art of warfare and perpetuating havoc and hell, only 5% or less during an actual declared war are actually doing that. The rest of the system seems to be supporting that. All this to say that the warfare is there, the violence is there, the terrorism, which is a big issue for us since 9/11, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict that we see, it's horrible. It's terrible. But it is also affecting a lot of people psychologically. But the number that are actually dead and dying and being killed, let's just say since 9/11, is dwarfed by the number of people dying in car accidents and from lung cancer in this country. We don't hear a lot about that in our media, but I'm bringing these things up to just balance how we look at, I guess, what we do get through our media lens, which is very much the horrors of warfare and national policy to manage all of that.
Yeah, we seem to see the dramatic side of death, whereas the kind of quiet passings go unnoticed by the media.
Well, we're certainly drawn towards the drama of death. I know we all have a morbid attraction. It seems to be a natural part of our makeup to be drawn to that. But another part of the perennial philosophy, to come back to that, is that there is no such thing as death. In fact, there may be, certainly from the Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, a type of what's called reincarnation, where there's a soul, whatever you want to call a non-physical source self, that manifests multiple lifetimes. And that gets into larger metaphysical questions about how does all of that work and toward what end and what purpose. But it's an interesting thing to consider, and it's something in the West we're very much still in that belief system that we are single personalities, we live and we die, and we're annihilated when we die. So the perennial philosophy teaches us that there, in a sense, is no death, meaning there's no annihilation of that self that is the source self. But it's physically manifest self certainly do pass the test of time and then pass away.
Which, like as you said, is the idea of the soul, which has existed in pretty much all religions as far back as we know, all that I can think of anyway. But the mainstream dominant viewpoint seems to, scientific viewpoint, I'd say, seems to not agree with that, and to maybe characterize it as childish or kind of a wishful thinking critique.
This is something that Ken Wilber calls the disaster of modernity or the modern world, and that is that the scientific materialism has actually destroyed the belief in this soul or this source self or these other ways of knowing, and that the five senses way of knowing, what we could just call the eye of the flesh, the eye of the body, which can be extended by other tools, which is science is wonderful at, think of electron microscopes, telescopes, and so on, that this eye of flesh and what it perceives is the only reality. And in fact, the perennial traditions show us that there are other ways that we can just call the eye of mind or the eye of contemplation, that there are these different parts. Once you are able, through yoga and meditative practices, which are well documented in this perennial wisdom, once you are able to turn off the senses, those five senses, there's this whole other reality and consciousness, awake awareized consciousness through different layers and levels that exists. And again, the bridge to that concept, to anyone listening, you know, you're trying to imagine, well, what the heck am I talking about, is your dream state. We all dream, each one of us. Most of us have learned not to remember our dreams. I've done a lot of work in the last 20 years on recording my dreams, analyzing my dreams, and trying to remember my dreams whenever I wake up. And once you gain a facility with that, even when you wake up, you're laying there in bed, you're still remembering the dream state. And it is such a different order of perception, to come back to this eye of mind, eye of contemplation. This is a bridge concept to access these other states of awareness, for lack of a better term, and to come back to science. Science, through its own agendas, has done well to sort of kill off the others, and so you have religion and science as very, very uneasy bed partners for the last 200-plus years. And this, though, is changing, and I guess I'll come back to that theme of integrating science and spirituality, not the ritualistic practices, because those are variable, those change. Even scientific experiments and equipment and so on changes. But this integration of these different ways of knowing, I think is just going to happen, you know, even from the point of view of all the wonderful scholars, thinkers, and smart people that are out there. Let's not forget the grassroots, the folk, the people, which is 98% of where all this stuff happens anyway, and all the great philosophical pretzel logic and endless meanderings of logic and pretzel logic are meaningless in that regard. So I want to bring that to the table, too. The folk that are out there and the people, what they're perceiving, what they're doing. Now, since we're trained not to tell people that we saw a man, that we woke up at 3 a.m. in the bedroom and there was a man standing there, and in fact it was President Clinton and he was talking to me. This is a story I heard from a friend. She was a waitress, and one of her customers shared this paranormal story with her. We're taught, you don't tell that to anybody because you're crazy. You'll get locked up, you'll get pumped full of Thorazine or other chemicals, and you learn not to share that. But the fact is, well, from my point of view anyway, that in this grassroots perspective, these kinds of things have always been happening, but, you know, people deal with them as they deal with them. When it becomes out of balance and pathological, you get some thing that might be called schizophrenia or personality disorder like that, dissociative personality disorder. But for the most part, people are balanced and they deal with it. The vast majority don't become pathological. So they're experiencing something like this, and I think anyone who's listening tonight has had some strange or paranormal experience in their life that they don't have a scientific explanation for, and what we're aware of scientifically of what's possible or considered real that can explain it away. And so you have this growing body of anecdotal evidence, so to speak, that scientists are starting to take seriously in the last 25, 35 years. And you have places like the Institute of Noetic Sciences that was in the Bay Area in Sausalito. I think they just moved up to Petaluma, founded by Edgar Mitchell, who had dedicated to this integration of science and spirit from a scientific method point of view, but making the assumption that what we're characterizing as the spiritual reality in the perennial traditions is real, and trying to prove it, trying to find ways and evolve the paradigm or the scientific model to prove it in a way that's repeatable. That's a key element of this integration, I think.
Yeah, I think so, because that's one of the probably the biggest selling point of the validity of science is the fact that you can, I guess that's what makes something a law, if you can, a scientific law, if you can repeat it in different places at different times with different people and get the same result, then that makes it reality.
Absolutely. It's predicting and controlling is what science does best in this very materialistic approach that it has. So, you know, even though the weather forecast is important, they're somewhat accurate for the next 24 hours. I would love to see a study of the fifth day of that five-day forecast to see its accuracy. And you're probably talking, you know, as far as temperature averages and so on, rain or not rain, I think it's very low. But it does help with people with their crops, and it translates into economic terms with the way we do business in this country and around the world. So science has gone hand in hand with the economic development, capitalism. I guess it didn't fare too well with socialism, but it's still a driving force behind our way of life, and I love it. I think it's the best system for all of its warts and bumps on the planet. I still think it's the best economic system that we have.
There's so many directions I can go in here. Maybe I would like to go back to, since we were really close to my namesake Vico's territory there with his contemporary Descartes, and Vico saw the danger of Descartes' ideas and theories at the time. Not that he disagreed with them, but that he saw a culture that was embracing them wholeheartedly and kind of tossing out all the rest of reality. And his fears have come to fruition probably more than he ever could have imagined. The mechanistic view of the universe that was pretty much given to us by Descartes has allowed science to kind of proclaim itself the one truth in the universe which has has its functioning and its developments have helped people somewhat, but it's proclaiming itself the only truth has I think harmed everyone and everything on this planet to a pretty large degree. Maybe you can talk about Descartes and
sure. The tie in there is, what is truth? Scientific method defines truth in its own way. Philosophers or meditators or other folks define truth in a different way. And basically what's happened is that scientific materialism, which can be traced back to the philosophy of Descartes, has won, so to speak, in the political and economic arena, so that what becomes economically viable either supports that. And here's just an example, and I will get to Descartes and his mind-body duality thing. But it was very evident to me in my tenure at the Science Museum that the budgets that were driving our educational programs were corporate sponsors and federal agencies like the National Science Foundation or the National Ocean and Atmospheric Association, NOAA, and whatnot. And they're all fine institutions, but their agendas drove what we could do and would shape our programs. So that was, in a sense, driving things, and that's just an example of how the scientific agenda drives economics and perpetuates, affects education, shall we say. But back to Descartes, he was, it's interesting, I've done some reading about him. He's an interesting fellow, apparently, and this is through the lens of Ken Wilber, the story I'm going to tell, that Descartes did have a paranormal experience. He did have a momentarily piercing of the veil or whatnot, and did have a sense that there was a spiritual realm and a physical realm. And somehow this got translated into the best way that he could, and he was really the first modern thinker of the modern world. His, let's just say, state of development or evolution, and again, this is speculation on Wilber's part, that the way that Descartes could interpret that paranormal experience went into what we can just call a modern mindset. And for whatever reason, his philosophy then was an attempt at interpreting that experience. As every philosopher, as every spiritual teacher, theologian, and scientist's philosophy is an attempt to translate their own level of perception or type of dominant perception that they have. And so we have this philosophical split of the mind and the body, and there have just been amazing amounts of psychic energy and resource put into arguing and debating philosophically, you know, where does love exist? Does it have what's called simple location? Does it exist physically? Love, compassion, joy? No, it doesn't. It's an interior subjective state, therefore it's not appropriate. It's an aspect of mind, but it's not appropriate from the body point of view representing the material world that we're going to look at. So you have this schizophrenic split that actually starts with Descartes. At least he gets credit for that. I think it's a much more subtle and complex story, the more historical research that goes on into these guys' belief systems and their other lesser-known works that kind of show other beliefs that they held. But again, every succeeding generation comes along and picks and chooses what works to their perception and then glums on them, like Darwin's theory of evolution and so on. So we have this, and it's still with us today, the separation of mind and body. And in an interesting feat of philosophical gymnastics, Ken Wilber offers a solution to that, which is kind of interesting, but I don't think the scientists are going to like it, because he basically says you cannot integrate mind and body unless you are in this translogical or non-dual meditative state through the eye of contemplation, because in that type of perception, the mind-body split is non-existent. They don't even exist. In fact, the objective world ceases to exist, but your sense of identity and being still exist. Now, people experience these things, these states. Most of them are temporary, but you get a taste of that, and it gives you at least some evidence in your own personal experience, as I suspect Ken Wilber has had, that there's something going on here. And that brings us back to the perennial part of the discussion. Descartes representing, say, the scientific materialist part of it.
Yeah, it's interesting that so many, as you were saying, so many people, even the scientists themselves, have had experiences that can't be explained by science, maybe paranormal or outside of three-dimensional reality, experiences of that nature, and yet the scientific view still persists, and somehow that didn't get into their work because it didn't, I guess, fit into the box of the papers that they're
writing.
Right,
and their funding sources. I mean, it's a business. Research, scientific research, is very much a business. You get government contracts, you get government grants, and corporate contracts and corporate grants. And those are economic capitalist, in some ways, other ideological agendas driving what's going to release the $1 million grant over 5 years or $200,000 grant over 3 years for your project. And so the political effect of that is that it changes your research and to pay your bills, because you believe in having a car and a house and the basic American lifestyle. You make the decision perhaps to compromise or to cleverly come up with a clever way to look at that. And I think there's some very clever scientists out there, and there's some fairly lazy ones, only in the sense that they don't want to push the envelope or the avant-garde or explore those anomalous, unknown areas, because they're unknown. And the problems are so difficult to articulate, much less come up with a methodology to reproduce these things in other laboratories and with other people around the world. But they just let that go and they continue as usual. So there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's sort of the normal way of doing business. But again, from a pure scientific point of view, you want to look at the anomalous areas. And I think cosmology or astrophysics, the guys that are using the Hubble data sets and observing the universe, is a very exciting area, because there was just an article, you know, you get these things in email and on websites about some observations, and it was a type of neutron star, which is a small collapsed star, but this didn't fit the model, and so that's an anomaly. And they're excited, they can't explain it. And now that challenges them to refine their theories, to come up with another data set and a way to interpret the data that's consistent, that's agreed by the peers, and becomes a sort of consensus view on how the universe is working. And so there is so much that we do not know. I think it's important to come back to that for all the Einsteins and Stephen Hawking's of the world. There's still a lot that those people never knew and couldn't possibly know.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions out there that mankind has been asking for a long time that science doesn't even really attempt to answer.
No, science is about quantities and measuring. It's not about value. It doesn't put a value on, just an example, say 200 dolphins wash up off the shores of Los Angeles, and they measure the algae content of the water and see that it's 5,000% higher than normal. That 5,000% has no good or bad to it. The number of 200 dead dolphins has no value to it. It's just an observation. It's a quantification. It's pure logic. And it's sterile, and it denies what it's not taking into consideration is that joy, compassion, horror, these emotional states, the interiors of the scientists themselves. And so it's kind of an interesting type of gymnastics that we're going through to try and come to terms with understanding how that works or doesn't work.
Yeah, I've noticed just from my own, this is by no means anything proven, but from my own personal experience, people that I know that are very logically oriented that tend to kind of not accept anything that can't be proved logically tend to, at least in my view, are setting themselves up for some very dangerous consequences. I think ignoring the rest of reality can, it might not hurt or kill you, but the odds are it quite likely will. And I also find that people generally with that mindset are incredibly unhappy, kind of miserable people, yet, strangely enough, they're in this weird situation where they don't realize it. They have no idea. They think that they're happy. I'm not sure what that is, but it seems obvious to anyone that they're not. And on a maybe on a that's from my personal perspective, but on a bigger scale, you have this scientific methodology like you're talking about. That's to not care about the dolphins washing up on the shore is a very dangerous position to put yourself in my view.
Absolutely. We're part of the world, what we call nature. Really, we're connected to, and to use the perennial storyline here, to connect to that, it says that everything is connected. In fact, this pure source, if you want to call it God, it's not an old white male with a gray beard who's a humanized figure up there in the sky, but it is some sort of sentient, awareized source. Then everything is an expression of it, is a variation of it, and in that sense is connected to it. And to ignore that connection has been this sort of horror story of the dark side of science, not to mention the technology for world wars. And I think of the recent and ongoing situation in Afghanistan, even Israel and the Palestinian territories, just the horror of those weapons being used on human beings, and the precision, and, we're very proud as Americans, and I have to admit, I begrudgingly admire the precision of targeted hell and annihilation that the technology brings, but it's still, having such an advanced weaponry is the direct result of science, and of course, think of World War II and the atom bomb, and then the hydrogen bomb that come after that, and if those technologies, I like to think, are in the hands of fairly responsible people, thinking of President Bush and his administration, certainly the Senate, the leaders of our country, military also, but to think of those weapons and technology getting in the hands of people who are less ethical or more ethical in their worldview, they wouldn't hesitate twice to drop that bomb on this country, or explode it somewhere else. So it's an interesting and dangerous dance that we have with the growth of technologies, and now you have cloning, these biotechnologies which are interesting. But I come back to the story of Frankenstein. There's no accident that story has become a popular myth. We grew up with it, and it represents science going wrong. Science not understanding God, basically. God the creator, man is trying to be God, and it doesn't quite have it right yet, and creates the monster. Like, why did Igor get the bad brain? I don't know. But he did. And it was horrible, you know. So these are interesting myths and stories that are in our movies and books and literature that reflect this balancing act between science and spirituality.
Yeah, I think this is quite a problem. It seems that in their individual lives, many people, as you say, go through a balancing act with science and spirituality. But I think since we live in a celebrity culture, I think even the whole discipline of science has become kind of celebrity as well, and the general populace somehow is, they're having these paranormal experiences themselves, but they're kind of taught to, you know, worship the higher people in the culture and to look up to them. And the official viewpoint that they're being told is that their experiences and maybe their wants and needs aren't, you know, not only will not be fulfilled, but are not even a valid discussion point. And not only that, it might be even dangerous to even mention their own experiences. Which, of course, sets up not a great situation for the majority of the people in this world. And I wonder if you can maybe address what are some of the dangers of this at this point? I'm kind of losing myself here, but
it's a complicated thing. You're mentioning the cult of personality that scientists fall into, and the celebrity and whatnot. When I was a science educator, you know, we would argue these cases, of course, to win our grants about the crisis in science education. But there, it is true that, at least in our culture, I can't speak to others, that, you know, the girls, we lose them, so to speak, around 8th grade, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, and it's more of a male pursuit, this science engineering thing that happens. And so there's a need, I guess is what I'm stating, to raise awareness and make science more palatable to the feminine side of the equation. And if you were to integrate intuition with intellect, and this is a very simplistic way of saying it, I think you would increase the feminine part of science, for lack of putting it in a clearer way, and certainly have more and better scientists pushing the envelope in different areas of research. I think that's going to happen. I think it's happening. It just takes time for these trends to emerge and for us to be able to see it and articulate it to ourselves. Because, of course, you know, back to that grassroots notion, even among the professional researchers and scholars that are out there, until they share their knowledge and until it gets watered down and shared with the masses, so to speak, and there are significant efforts and people trying to do that. Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, I think, is a good example of a book that gets very popular, or Brian Greene's The Elegant Universe, which he attempts to deal with a very complicated subject of superstring theory, is a way to bring that knowledge to the people to raise awareness. So I think that's a process that science is aware of. It's very much a process.
Oh, I'm gonna have to break in and cut you off there because sure. We need to go for our station identification, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes, and we'll pick up right where we left off. This is 93.7 San Francisco Liberation Radio.